This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm with Professor Douglas Scott from the University of British Columbia. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for talking to us today. So you've been visiting Jodrell Bank and Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, and you gave a talk on the current state of cosmic microwave background studies, and especially focusing on the Planck experiment. Regular Jodcast listeners will be quite familiar with the Planck experiment. We've had quite a few Planck people interviewed on the Jodcast, but this year is the 50th anniversary of the first discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation by Penzias and Wilson. So maybe run us through a little bit of the history of the study of the CMB and eventually explain why it's still extremely important today.
Yeah, so as you said, it was 1965 when Penzias and Wilson, who later won the Nobel Prize for this work, discovered the cosmic microwave background, which people often talk about as the sort of echo of the Big Bang or the noise from the early universe. It took a long time to establish that radiation has a thermal spectrum, what we call a black body, which means that it comes from a source which is in very good equilibrium, meaning that it's at one temperature, not heating up or cooling down, no spectral lines, no chemistry that you can do with that. It's just this physics radiating substance. And that comes from everywhere in the universe, as far as we can tell, everywhere we point. And that tells us, once we had established that it was this black body, tells us that the whole universe was once in thermal equilibrium. And the only way we know of to do that is called the hot Big Bang model. So this is a cornerstone of our whole view of how the universe worked. It used to be hot and dense and has been expanding and cooling. So that was established really by the 1970s. And then people started to look for, are there deviations in this black body spectrum? And are there places on the sky that are hotter or colder than other places? So eventually it was the COBE satellite in 1992 that established that there are variations in temperature in the sky, what we call anisotropies. And we call them that because it's hard to pronounce, and you can tell whether people really work on the CMB by whether they can say anisotropies properly. But the idea is that you make a map of part or all of the sky, trying to see if the intensity or the temperature varies from place to place. That was eventually discovered in 1992. And since then, people have been mapping this as a function of angular scale more and more precisely until now we have results from Planck. Planck launched in 2009, worked for about 4 years, managed to map the sky many, many times. And we're now in the full throes of analyzing not only the temperature data, but also the polarization information we get. And Planck has provided, by studying these anisotropies in detail, the numbers that describe the entire universe. So we now have this highly quantified model where it's not only that there was a Big Bang, the universe used to be hotter and denser, but we can tell you precisely what kind of Big Bang, you know, how old the universe is, how fast it's expanding, how much dark matter and dark energy and something about the seed perturbations that were made in the very earliest times, maybe in a period of inflation that made all the structure in the entire universe, including, you know, people and planets and so on eventually. So it's become, you know, these numbers which describe the whole universe come essentially from Planck. So these are, you know, this is the textbook description of the universe that we're finding. So, I mean, sometimes people complain that it's boring, that we just measure precise numbers over and over again. But these are, you know, these are the numbers that describe your universe. And I often, I mean, I know lots of people follow sports teams or something. And if you ask them information about their favorite batsman or forward in soccer or whatever, they can reel off statistics, which are much more precise than if you ask them questions about the whole universe.
Yeah.
So it seems to me we ought to be able to describe the whole universe at least as well as you can describe somebody's batting average or something. And that's where we are. We now have, you know, the numbers that describe the whole universe to really extreme precision. And then the questions are, where do these numbers come from, right? Why is the universe the way it is?
Absolutely. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that we can actually do that. People don't really think on the scale of the entire universe. When you start talking about cosmology to someone who has little or no prior knowledge of it, they sort of go, wow, so you can actually describe the whole universe. And yeah, I think that's one of the reasons the study of the CMB is so amazing. But one thing is that the people associate, so people who have heard of the CMB, they'll probably picture this sort of oval-ish map that has a lot of speckles on it, and, you know, the blue bits are the cold bits and the red bits are the warm bits. how, I think it'd be interesting for our listeners to try and grasp how you go from that map to these famous numbers, these parameters that describe the whole universe.
So obviously, in reality, it's really a lot of work.
Yeah.
And there's many steps involved, and it takes years to grind through the data. So, mm-hmm. I should not give the impression that this is trivial. But the basic concept of what you're doing is actually very straightforward. So the information in the sky is not recorded in, you know, is there a hot spot in this place or a cold spot in this place? It's only the scatter in the hot and cold temperatures that carries the information. So it's the variance of that temperature map that's really the information. So what you're effectively doing is you make a map of the sky with pixels of some size. You calculate the variance in that map. So you literally, you know, square all the things in the map and average them together. And you write down that number, right? The variance for that pixel size is some number. And then you change the pixel size, make bigger or smaller pixels, and you redo that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just write down the variance as a function of many, many pixel sizes. And that's the quantity that carries all the information. So what we actually do is we do that in a lot more mathematically precise way.
Yeah.
But it's essentially equivalent to that. So you can, you know, you could give a map to a high school student and say, you know, work out the variance as mm-hmm. a function of pixel size. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, very, very equivalent to what we do. It's just, you know, how many pixel sizes do you look at and what are the error bars and so on? And you realize that you need to be a little more hardcore.
Sure.
But it is that's all you're doing. So it's just that the variation in temperature as a function of the angular separation between parts of the sky is a function of that angular separation.
Mm-hmm.
And that function is defined purely by the parameters of the model. And right now we have a model that only requires six parameters to describe it.
Okay.
So we can pin down those six parameters very, very precisely.
So it's pretty much a statistical process then. Like, yeah, that's what you're trying to say. So from these six parameters and from this model, you can then extract almost any quantity you like about the universe itself?
So there are many other parameters depend on these basic six, right?
Okay.
So I mean, the six that we measure are the ones that are easiest to measure for the CMB. They're not actually the ones that are easiest to describe to people, but they basically tell you something to do with the geometry of the CMB, a little bit of scattering that happened recently, to two parameters describing the initial conditions,
mm-hmm.
and then how much dark matter and how much regular atomic matter there is. So those are the six numbers. And from that, once you've defined those six, you can tell what the age of the universe is or the amount of dark energy or the many other things are derived from those parameters. So we now know, you know, for example, that the age of the universe is 13.8 gigayears old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people don't realize that we now think we know the age of the universe to three digits. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an approximate science. It's a very, very precise science.
Sure.
We know how much dark matter, how much dark energy, you know, really quite precisely. We have no idea where these numbers really come from. There's about six times as much dark matter as regular matter.
Yeah.
Nobody has a clue for where this number six comes from. Why isn't it 7 or 73? Or we don't know. We don't know what the dark energy is. It makes the universe accelerate. We have no idea exactly what it is. We call it dark energy to give it a name, but
yeah.
We really don't know what it is.
Yeah.
We don't know where the initial conditions came from. There's an idea called inflation that in the very early universe, quantum perturbations grow to be regular density perturbations in a period of rapid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be correct. It may not be. We don't really know where these perturbations come from. But one of the amazing things about studying the CMB is you can empirically to tackle these questions. You don't just have to kind of sit in the bar and mumble with your mates about what the universe might be like.
Yeah.
You can go out there and see what the universe is like and learn about where these perturbations came from. That to me is one of the most amazing things is it's, I guess in the 1950s and 60s, you know, there were no full-time cosmologists. People kind of did it at the weekend when nobody was looking or something.
Cause sure.
You felt a little bit ashamed of working on the whole universe. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But you know, now we actually have a description of the whole universe. It's quite extraordinary that the universe lets us do that, that it's simple enough that, you know, human beings right now have the ability to make these measurements. But of course, when you've made the measurements and got the numbers, there's more questions.
Yeah.
So we don't know where this is going. We don't know whether we're going to learn more about inflation, or the dark energy will turn out to be different, or we require some other kind of stuff, dark something else. We have no idea what's coming next, but there's still a lot to learn.
Yeah, the way you mentioned these sort of parameters we have, and we don't know why there's X times more dark mass than dark energy, kind of draws a bit of a parallel with particle physics, where they're also kind of, they've got their standard model and they have X amount of particles, but they don't know, you know, why there are 5 particles instead of 6 or whatever. And it's hit a bit of a, sorry, particle physics is kind of coming to a point where they're now just throwing particles around at higher and higher energies to kind of figure out new things. And do you think that maybe with something like cosmology and something like Planck, where sometimes the perception is that we're just refining the numbers, but we're not really finding anything new. And do you think that, is it just going to keep going and, oh, we're going to get smaller and smaller error bars? Or do you think that something else needs to sort of change?
There's a lot of analogy between the standard model of particle physics and the modern, what you might call the standard model of cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes people criticize particle physics for success.
Yeah.
So it's been so successful that people chase after tiny little hints of something wrong, and they've chased those up for, you know, about 40 years. And it's all looking pretty good. And you know that it's not the ultimate model because, as you say, I mean, nobody knows why the proton is 2,000 times as heavy as the electron.
Yeah.
I mean, where does that come from? There's nothing. So it's not a complete theory, but it's a completely mathematically described theory with, you know, 20 some free parameters.
Sure.
And within that, you can make measurements and they all turn out to be basically right. And then the Higgs was the particle that had to be there and hadn't been found. And now it looks like it's found. And so, you know, cosmologists would say, oh, well, you know, we're making all these measurements. It's not like particle physics. But in fact, the standard model of cosmology goes back to, you know, something like the early 1990s. So, I mean, it predates even the supernova acceleration discoveries. It was the best model of cosmology about 25 years ago. So, and it's just got better and better and more firm.
Yeah.
One of the differences with particle physics is that at least is a complete theory with, you know, that you've described the theory in a certain mathematical way. And within that way, there's nothing that you can add, really.
It's sort of self-contained.
It's self-contained. You would have to go beyond the theory to get a more fundamental theory that's completely different.
Right.
Whereas the model of cosmology is just phenomenological. You just invent enough stuff that it works.
Right.
And the bizarre thing is that you would have expected by now we would have had to invent more stuff to make it work, and it doesn't look like that we've needed to do that.
Okay.
There is no evidence for a 7th parameter that we require. Everybody expects that this can't possibly be the whole story because it's not a self-contained theory. But, you know, who knows what the next thing is we're going to discover.
Sure.
But we do know if you want a theory of everything, then you need to explain not only the standard model of particle physics, but also the standard cosmological model. So if you think some string theory model or something produces all of particle physics at low energy, then it also has to explain where the dark matter comes from, what the dark energy is, and how inflation worked. So all of these things are completely wound up in fundamental physics questions.
Mm, it's a sort of known unknowns and unknown unknowns sort of thing where we know what we're trying to, we have question marks that we see and we're trying to solve, and then maybe something will pop out of the blue. Coming back to inflation, so one of the things that kind of put the CMB in the news recently was the BICEP 2 results, and they thought they'd found a trace of gravitational waves which would have provided a signature for inflation. It turned out that it was just dust that provided those little B modes. So that's sort of the most immediate known unknown. So the most immediate thing that potentially further study of the CMB could solve. What is the expectation, I guess, for those? So BICEP and Planck are now working together. So what's the sort of expectation of things to come in that direction?
So you could see by the reaction that caused how big a deal that would be.
Yeah.
So in some concrete way, you would prove that all the structure in the universe came from quantum mechanical perturbations and have some hint as to how the theory of inflation worked, which may in principle give you a hint about what the more fundamental physics concepts are that we need to explain everything.
Yeah.
So this is a really big deal. It requires making measurements of the polarization of the CMB to exquisite precision with a full understanding of all the effects that come up in the experiment, which is difficult. The CMB is polarized,
Yep.
It's polarized at a very weak level, and that's hard enough. But these so-called B modes, this swirly pattern in the polarization, as people described it, that signal is really, really weak.
Mm-hmm.
So you really need to go to not. So I mean, the CMB temperature is about 3 Kelvin, and the perturbations in the CMB have temperatures measured in microKelvin. The polarization is around the sort of microKelvin level, the sort of general polarization. These B modes, you need to be talking about nanoKelvin.
I see.
So it's crazy weak signals.
Mm.
Polarization is hard enough. Weak polarization is really hard. This is very, very difficult. There are many groups now working hard on CMB polarization experiments. So you're only going to hear more and more of this stuff.
Yeah.
Whether somebody else will detect, actually make a firm detection of primordial B modes proving inflation remains to be seen. But people are trying. But it's not easy.
Yeah.
But the BICEP team showed that they had the sensitivity. They were the most sensitive experiment in a tiny little part of the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
They went way deeper than anybody had gone before. But at one frequency, you need to do this at many frequencies. You need to compare to other experiments. You need to cross-check and so on. And this is very difficult to do.
Was Planck even expected to provide results with this kind of sensitivity? I mean, I think it's just at the edge, isn't it, of what Planck can do, a little bit beyond it.
Planck's advantage is that you have the whole sky, but plus you have multi-frequency. So what Planck is on the edge of being able to do is the larger angle polarization, which an experiment like BICEP can't do because it only looks at a small part of the sky.
Right.
So the combination of Planck and BICEP is particularly powerful, and Planck will be used by other experiments as a monitor of the stuff that's in the way of the primordial signal. So the Planck data will continue to be used for decades, I suspect, as an all-sky monitor of these foregrounds as you're trying to get to the background. So Planck will remain valuable for some time to come, just because all sky requires a satellite, essentially.
Yeah.
And getting these multi-frequencies, also the higher frequencies, you just can't do at all from the ground, and even the lower frequencies are hard. So one of the legacies of Planck is it will be continued to be used in combination with these other experiments, which is interesting.
Okay. Having said that, what is the future for sort of space-based CMB missions? Because, well, a lot of people are looking at Planck and saying, well, we're just getting more and more refined numbers, and the obvious new target is this polarization. So is there another satellite mission in the works to get even better CMB data?
There's certainly planning for such a thing. It's not fully on the table right now. It's a little bit unclear exactly what you would design. So people are still in the discussion process. And you can combine that with other things. So that, how many frequencies do you want? What angular scales do you want? How sensitive? And so on. So these discussions are all underway. So, I mean, if the BICEP thing had been correct, it would have been all systems go to confirm and measure that with higher and higher precision. And it would have been fairly clear what to design. So now that's clearly not a primordial signal, but it's a real B mode signal, but it appears to come largely from dust in the Milky Way. It's not clear what the target is right this minute, I would say.
Okay.
So that may be, a little more discussion. It may become clearer what the path is to doing that. But, there's certainly a lot more information up there in the CMB and polarization.
Sure.
But to get much more polarization data, you would go to the very smallest angular scales. And those are not the most useful for this B-mode study.
Uh-huh.
So there's a sort of tension between the best thing for this fundamental physics question and the best thing for many other questions. So I don't think it's, there might be other people out there who have a very clear vision and they're just about to submit a proposal, so I might be wrong. But I don't think it's very clear right this minute what the next generation CMB mission will be, but I'm pretty confident there will be one.
Okay.
And it will have polarization as a main driver.
Yeah. Yeah, that would make sense. Anything else? I mean, that was a great...
I mean, I probably talked for long enough.
Yeah.
Big thing is what's called non-Gaussianity.
Mm.
So there is a big push to do that. But actually, the CMB, we've almost run out of information to constrain that. So this is, when we talked about taking the variance of the map, this is like taking 3 points on in your map and combining them. Okay. To get a thing which would be zero if they were very simple perturbations. And the idea is that there could well be a very small signal in there that tells you something new and exciting about the seed perturbations. So people are really focusing on that. The math is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of theorists working hard on how you estimate that. If you try and do the full estimation, it takes forever on a supercomputer. So there's a lot of crunching of numbers and being clever with algorithms and so on.
Yeah.
And you can combine the CMB with galaxy surveys and so on. So these galaxy surveys are three-dimensional. The CMB is just a two-dimensional projection of the sky. There's a lot more information in 3D.
Sure.
So in the future, we expect that with big missions that are coming, ground-based and space-based, there's going to be a lot of emphasis on seeing if you can measure this tiny little non-Gaussianity thing and learn something new about inflation. So in terms of what's coming for fundamental, I mean, people would like to know what's the dark energy and so on, but we have no guess for how easy that will be to do. But the non-Gaussianity, I think, is a real thing, which is coming.
Okay.
We will hear a lot more about, and it's very difficult to explain to people in a podcast interview.
Yeah. Sure. Great. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. That was a really insightful look at the CMB. So thanks for talking to us, Douglas.
You're welcome.
And maybe catch you some other time on the podcast. Thanks.